Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Today, we're going to talk about the speed of software. Yeah, you heard me right, software. Now, fighter pilots have a saying that speed is life, and it applies to everything from the speed at which you enter a dogfight, fly a low-level ingress, shoot a missile, or exit a threat ring. And when trying to achieve a qualitative advantage over an adversary, we often think about how fast we can field a better jet, a more lethal missile, or a bigger bomb. But today, so many of our combat capabilities rely on software. The advantage is in the algorithm. And software can change much faster than hardware, which means that the ability to change software to adapt to the ever-changing battle space will be a key to victory in future warfare. It seems like this should be easy, right? I mean, how many of us get nightly updates to our computer software, our phone updates, our apps, or even our cars? Companies are consistently sending out new features or patching vulnerabilities on an as-needed basis. So why can't the military do the same? Well, the honest answer is that the bureaucratic systems that the military has in place to buy and modernize equipment is set up for a hardware-centric force. It's just not structured to support or adapt software and timelines that are combat relevant. And it isn't just the organizations for acquisitions and management that aren't right. It's everything from the color of money to how the personnel get funded. Now, part of the reason we have got to get the bureaucracy right is the fact that we now have the ability to adapt software in real time, and the bureaucracy must modernize to enable those lightning fast changes. So let's first talk with Lieutenant Colonel Mike Benitez, who many of you may know as the guy behind the newsletter, The Merge. But in his day job, Mike is the Director of Staff at the 53rd Wing at Eglin Air Force Base. Hey, Mike, really appreciate you joining us today. And I understand recently that the 53rd Wing demonstrated the ability to update the F-16's mission data file in flight. And for those of us that flew the F-16 and took it into combat, we can understand why this is such a huge deal. Mike, do you mind to describe what a mission data file is and why it's so important?
Sure. Thanks for having me. First of all, to explain what a mission data file is, it helps by first explaining why we have a mission data file in the first place. So almost everything in the battle space emits an electronic signal. So usually that meant radar, but in the modern battle space, it can include a ton of other things like data links and even transponders. So there's this complex signal environment, and we have complex combat aircraft out there, and they have to have equipment that can listen to it. So the purpose of that data file is to be able to be the translator for the aircraft so it can understand what it's detecting so it knows what to do. Sometimes this is the display the right symbol so the operator in the cockpit knows what the threat is. And other times it's so the aircraft can automate a corrective action through an electronic countermeasure so the operator can kill and survive. So without the mission data file, the aircraft can detect the signal, but it doesn't know what to do with it. Or worse, some platforms, if they detect the signal and they don't know what to do with it, they won't even show the operator that there's an unknown threat out there. So it's the quickest way without the MDF. It's the quickest way that we can lose our situational awareness. We can slow down our tactical decision-making, cede the advantage to the adversary, and ultimately incur friendly losses.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that explanation. And it just brings me back to, you know, flying the early version of the Block 40, where just trying to find space in the OFP and the MDF so that they could properly display bullseye. And basically, you know, we call it bullseye, but it showed up like a home plate symbol because it just, you know, they didn't have the capability to write more code to make it happen. So it's really impressive what's being done. So, I want to transition now and think about, you know, we've put so much effort and focus on our MDF because if we didn't, we couldn't identify the signal, as you mentioned, and it also meant we couldn't shoot it, we couldn't protect ourselves from it, and it also meant that if the bad guys deliberately changed their signals by tweaking it in their software, it was really hard to catch up. So can you describe how this process works to get the information into the cockpit?
Yep, sure can. So the mission data file, it's essentially a lookup table of threat parametrics. So if you think of it as an Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of data and blocks. So that's a key point that people need to remember because the entire paradigm is reactive. And what I mean by that when I say that is to build that file, the threat's parametrics have to be known, analyzed, and characterized. Then after that, then the file has to be built in one of our labs. Then after that, it has to be emailed from the lab to a maintenance unit for that particular squadron. Then it has to be downloaded and installed into a loading device. Then an individual has to take that device, connect it to each individual aircraft on the flight line to upload the file so that the next time that aircraft flies, it can use it. And so anytime a new signal is detected, whether it's a new threat or just a tweak to a signal of an existing threat, it has to go through that entire process.
Well, Mike, that timeline might have worked in the 80s, but we all know how quickly software can rewrite and change things. And you all have recently demonstrated the ability to update a fighter's mission data file while it was in flight. So can you tell us about this crazy development?
Yeah, I sure can. So the big story is that we used the mission data file as a test because it's a very simple way to show people the value of what we did. So our test was really about software and networks, seeing if we could build a highway to connect the data lab directly to all airborne F-16s anywhere in the world, send them a file, and reprogram an onboard operational system. And we did it. While the lab was at Hill Air Force Base and the aircraft was flying on the Nellis Range, we're about 400 miles apart, the data traveled over 40,000 miles because we bounced it off a satellite in geo. But I really want to foot stomp that it's a demonstration to prove a concept and really how we're trying to hack the systems to connect things for the warfighter. So think long-range kill chains, getting airborne crypto updates, maintaining custody of weapons quality tracks, and anything else that you can think of in your imagination. And unfortunately, there's no holistic approach to better integrate software and networks across the portfolios of weapons programs that we have. And that's because there's no one in charge to do with it.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing what you're describing. But Mike, I cannot thank you enough for being with us today. I know you guys are super busy, and thanks for all you're doing.
Thanks, Slick. Appreciate it.
To describe the problems that our warfighters face in adapting software and networks at the battlespace edge, we've brought in our own senior fellow, Heather Lucky Penny, who many of our regular listeners are probably familiar with. So, Lucky, why is this so urgent?
Hey, Slick. It's great to be back. So, you know, we've all heard General Brown's charge to accelerate change, but what does this mean? In our research, we've identified three principles to this adaptive advantage, right? So the first is speed, right? Adaptation has to not just be faster than old blue, but we've got to be faster than red. We have to be able to outpace our adversaries. Second, those changes must provide a real operational benefit. It doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to be better than what we had last time. And this might be a short-term or a long-term advantage, transient or enduring, limited in scope or enterprise-wide, right? You know, but what's key is that benefits relevant to the competitive context. And that, you know, that could be either at the tactical edge or it could be broadly and strategically. Okay, and finally, these changes must impose confounding effects on the adversary and confer resilient complexity to friendly forces. So in other words, it denies our adversaries effective targeting or the anticipated advantage of attriting blue forces. So this is how adaptation is the new advantage and speed is the new offset. This is what accelerate change means. So future operational concepts like multi or all domain operations, JADC2, and so forth, seek to harness these principles. And a key way of doing that is not just what weapons and aircraft we buy, because we know right now that takes a really long time, but how we use them in new and creative ways that will make the difference.
Now, Lucky, that is a really good primer, but what does this all have to do specifically with software and networks?
Yeah, exactly, right? Our operational architectures, that's how we fight, what we have in the battle space and what those relationships and interdependencies are, that will be the main adaptive advantage. So this means that our battle networks, our data links, because that's how we talk, those are our relationships, that's really becoming the foundation of how we fight. So that's where the software and networks comes in. And this reliance will only increase in the future. These architectures will need to be able to fight even while adversaries are attacking our networks. So when I talk about architectures, I'm referring to how we fight, the relationships and interdependencies between our aircraft, our sensors, weapons and satellites, and so forth, and the information they have to exchange. So you can literally diagram this stuff out. And in the Pentagon, they call this an overview chart. For all of us, you know, weenies who were there, it's an OV1, right? The structure of how we exchange information to execute our tactics. That's what I mean by the architecture. And again, this is dependent upon software and networks. To prevail in a peer conflict, we need to be able to change these architectures faster than adversaries can attack them. So if an aircraft as a node or a network goes down, we have to be able to shift our operations seamlessly, just like jujitsuing our tactics. Software programs and what we call mission integration tools are what will enable this kind of ever-changing and evolving operation. So these mission integration tools are the software programs that can facilitate software adaptation. It's a lot like updating a mission data file, like what Mike talked about, or creating a new architecture, a new network architecture. They let us do the adaptation without having to make big programmatic changes or waiting on long modernization timelines. Because if I can make these changes quickly and at the unit level, that's going to matter most.
Yeah, you know, when Mike was explaining what he and the Air Warfare Center did with upgrading the F-16 mission data files real time, I just brought me right back to the cockpit as a mission seed lead, building the lowdown and trying to pass data in the battle space. And of course, I want to stay unclassified here, but if we had the ability to monitor and see what the enemy's signals were doing and be able to, you know, update the pods software so they could, you know, maybe sniff a radar a little bit differently or better to be able to build that lowdown faster. Or if they're, you know, somebody might've tweaked a radar signal and now it's not showing up, but somehow we were able to figure that out. And to real time add that software to the jet was just be a complete game changer.
Yeah. And as Mike was saying, that demonstration wasn't just about the mission data file. It was about any kind of software packet or any kind of software update. That's amazing, right? You think about that. That is the future. So these demonstrations are great and they point to what is possible, but it's incredibly difficult to operationalize this kind of adaptation. Because believe it or not, you know, the primary barrier to being able to normalize what Mike was doing is bureaucratic. So the first barrier is simply just the color of money, right? Money scares people because that's how you go to jail. It's pretty serious stuff, but the funding categories that we have today within the Pentagon are fundamentally ill-suited for the pace of software development. The rate at which we obligate money for different activities and the limitations we have on who can spend what, that prevents us from fielding software tools or doing the kinds of updates that Mike's talking about. So funding categories is a huge barrier. The next is a lack of having a dedicated system program office. So data links, which are the hardware and the waveforms that connect the force, they're typically managed as part of the overall capability package of a major weapon system. You kind of heard Mike allude to that earlier. As such, they're subjugated to that platform's developmental and modernization timelines and program priorities. Too often, mission integration gets classified as just comms and it falls below the cut line. And finally, our networks are constructed at the COCOM level, right? They take months to engineer. Our data link architecture should reflect our operational concepts. The challenge is because different kinds of data links are incompatible and they've got very unique data messages and languages and fixed structures. It takes trained experts to build these broad battle networks and to be able to optimize that connectivity and reflect how we want to fight. And because a network is so difficult to change, it means we can't change how we fight. So if we're going to answer this call to accelerate change, if we're going to outpace, out-adapt our adversaries, we have to be able to address these bureaucratic barriers to fielding mission integration software tools so we can provide our forces, our airmen at the edge, this kind of adaptive advantage.
Well, Lucky, before we dive down into the rabbit hole of how bureaucracy slows us down, I want to dig deeper into what you mean by mission integration tools and why they're so revolutionary and how they're different from how we modernize our weapon systems in the networks today.
Yeah, sure, Slick. So, you know, the short answer is that the mission integration tools are software tools, they're programs, and they're not platform specific. So they can build the operational and functional relationships that we want among the platforms we have based off our mission requirements, not the hardware limitations. So it's really shifting our mindset from what can we do to what do we want to do. These software tools can do things like enable weapon systems to understand each other without the need for standard data messages. They can optimize battle network configurations across different data links. They can quickly identify and build novel kill chains and so forth. I mean, they can allow machine-to-machine functionality. You know, so it's really exciting that these mission integration tools, we don't have to wait for the future force. We can actually begin employing future operational concepts today with the force that we have. And because these software tools don't rely on a common or universal standard, they're backwards and forwards compatible. So they can be the bridge between our legacy force, our current force, and our future force.
Yeah, it's absolutely mind-blowing and hard to imagine the capabilities that this agile integrated software can do for us. And with these mission integration tools, you know, they're just not like a science experiment. It's stuff that's happening out there now, and the software development is happening at a totally different pace than what the hardware pace is. You know, we talked about jets and missiles. I mean, obviously, that takes forever compared to software, where they may already be mature enough to field. So it's really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, Slick. I mean, this stuff is here today. We just heard it from Mike, and it's amazing all the other efforts that are going on around the DoD.
Now, to describe one mission integration tool that has the potential to have an outsized impact on operations, we brought in Dr. Jimmy Reb Jones, a fighter pilot PhD who also worked at DARPA, developing a program they called Stitches. So, Rev, thanks so much for being here. And can you quickly describe how Stitches works and what it can do?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate your time and your interest. So Stitches is a software that we generated in my my DARPA project for the creation of systems of systems. Stitches itself is a software-only suite, and it's an entire suite of integration products that generate lightweight software that take existing human-readable products and convert them into machine-readable code. And all of this output actually ends up creating a system of systems from fielded as-is components without changing any source code at all. So just that statement alone of all those different this and those is really the reason it was DARPA hard. Stitches takes the very high level and then compiles and generates the interoperability glueware all the way down to the tactical level.
Yeah. It's really amazing, Rev. And, you know, being a Viper guy, I understand the importance of software and how long it takes for this stuff to come out and get fielded. And it just seems like this capability in one tool is absolutely amazing. So I've got to ask, is Stitches being used right now in the field? Because it seems all that we're talking about with JADC2, multi-domain operations, et cetera, that Stitches would be like the no-brainer program to have in the hands of the warfighter.
Yeah, in fact, it is. It is a fielded tool chain, and in that sentence itself is a bit odd because Stitches is used to generate new systems of systems. So the things that it outputs every time it's used, it creates something that frankly has never been created before. But it's the same chain, no matter whether you want to connect something that is fairly simple to connect together or something you never thought you before. But in short, not only is it fielded, but I'm actively applying it to the new Air Force Spectrum Warfare Wing, and it was part of the funding for FY22 POM that's there by the Air Force. So we're actively using it in the field, and it's taken the DoD by storm because it works, and it's been working, and we've been applying it with real systems since about 2016.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, it seems to me that like funding for something like this, you know, the proverbial colors of money and things like that would be a real issue. Did you find that in the initial fielding with Stitches that it was an issue, or was it really plug and play and folks just adapted to it right away?
Well, so the technology is relatively plug and play, but the disruption that is caused by the technology itself, which is is in the first sentence of DARPA's mission statement to cause disruption, is causing a disruption for the DoD and not only how we employ things like this, but how we fund things like this. Because as I mentioned, you can use the tool chain to go from Pentagon level all the way down to or MAGCOM level all the way down to the implementation at the warfighter level in the space of one tool chain. And what I haven't said before is that once you know what you want to create, you can generate those interoperabilities in basically a matter of minutes. To if you want to take an hour or two to plan your story, that's how long it takes. So when you look at that speed of that capability that we already have fielded, people from both sides, from either side of that spectrum, don't know how to fund it. From the RDT&E standpoint, where a typical program office would stand put, would ingest things in, it looks like a tactical product. So it's an O&M type thing, 3400 money. If you look at it from the operator standpoint, there's a number of things that we got to do just to be able to get you to be able to do that, like adapt a subsystem over a couple of days. They clearly look like RDT&E. So for each other's perspective, it's somebody else's cash. Senior leadership understands how important these tools are, and really has devised a way to fielding stitches via some pretty good laser focus from around the DOD as well as the Air Force. But this one-off fielding isn't likely scalable to the next technologies that are like this that are close behind. The funding for stitches is currently secure and is good. But it just applies to the Spectrum Warfare Wing, even though the technology applies to all of the DoD and JADC2 missions.
Well, Rev, I can't say thanks enough, except for the hives that popped up when you started bringing up all of the jargon, brought me back to my A58 days in the Pentagon. And it's just so difficult to get your mind around, but thank goodness we have experts like you that understand how to weave through the matrix to make this happen for the warfighter. So thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate your time. Thanks for the interest.
Lucky, I just can't believe that we have such transformative, powerful software, these tools that are here, and we can't field it because we don't have the right kind of money in the right places.
Yeah, you know, that's right, Slick. So I'm really happy to see that Stitches has progressed to where it is today, but the bottom line is Stitches can be either a pathfinder or an exception. You know, the color of money is one of the biggest barriers that these kinds of adaptive software tools face. And this problem ranges from the developmental money not being able to keep up with the speed of software to the adaptive nature of the software being defined by the lawyers as developmental and therefore not eligible for funding in operational accounts. So I got to say, you know, stick with me because this gets really creepy. But, you know, like I said, people go to jail over money, so the details matter. And there's not really any wiggle room when it comes to how you apply the funding. And this is a major problem for getting these mission integration tools to the warfighter. You know, regarding the speed of development, software programs can go from idea to viable program well inside of a year. I mean, you heard Mike say that when they did their MDF experiment, I mean, it was a matter of months. You've heard, Rev say that they can make new stitches adaptations in hours, right? But the kinds of monies that fund developmental activities are annual outlays that are related to the stage of the product. And there's all these different levels, and they're supposed to correspond to the type of technical readiness level, and it takes years. Now, Congress has recognized this doesn't fit the software, so it's created a budget activity, a code, a color of money, that's intended to capture the full life cycle of software in one category, aka 1 year, right? So this should let software speed from concept to product. But this is only a pilot program at this point, this budget color, and it only applies to massive software programs that have already been through the standard Pentagon JSITS process. We need to figure out how to enable these unique software programs to be funded both seamlessly from the research all the way through operational and normalized fielding, right? Otherwise, the color money is going to slow down the speed at which these software tools can be developed and prevent them from reaching the warfighter.
Got it. So, Heather, how is mission integration managed today?
Well, you know, the short answer is it's really not. You know, traditionally, we don't do mission integration. We do mission engineering. You know, like how our weapon systems exchange data interact is all predefined in development. Remember me talking about the JSITS process? Yeah, this is where it gets baked in. And it's fixed in production and it's really planned out in modernization. So when weapon systems are designed, we think about what kind of data exchanges they'll need, i.e. like how they're going to play in the battle space with other weapon systems. And that really defines the attributes of what their software and their data links is going to be. So you can kind of look at F-22 as a prime example. It has the data length, the iFiddle. It was understood that when F-22 was designed back in the 80s and the 90s, that it would be able to receive Link 16 data, but nobody wanted the F-22 to transmit Link 16 because it's a big omnidirectional homing beacon. So instead, what it got was iFiddle. It allowed that to communicate with its flight, other F-22s, but not anyone outside of the F-22. It's a stealthy data link. It's low probability of detection and low probability of intercept. Well, when the F-35 was developed, data link technology had advanced significantly. So in addition to hosting the full Link 16 capability with the option of on and off, the F-35 program developed MADL, a multifunctional advanced data link. But now the F-22 and the F-35 couldn't talk to each other because their hardware and their waveforms were different, and they still can't. That's mission engineering, not mission integration.
All right, Lucky, I get it. And now this explains why our networks and operational architectures are pretty static, because they can only fit together one way.
Exactly, right? So you can imagine how difficult it can be then to build our battle networks. So without mission integration software tools, developing a campaign level operational architecture, think of how complex and thorny that systems engineering problem is. And the only way to wrap your arms around it is to centralize that kind of work. So we have trained specialists to build this network. You know, they're called Joint Integration Control Officers, or JICOs. These officers are typically pulled from the air battle management field because air battle managers understand the nuances of how U.S. and coalition forces employs a system. They get the operational architecture, right? So then we train these JICOs in the Byzantine rule sets of how weapon systems have to be combined in the network architecture. It is really administrative because of how fixed these networks are and how difficult it is to make them integrate. So this centralized management means that the networks can't quickly respond to a changing battle space where actual and virtual attrition is occurring. You know, planes being shot down, jamming going on, data links under attack. Adversaries are well aware of the structure of our data links and their rule sets, and they know how to target them. This creates significant vulnerabilities in how we plan to operate.
No, you're really describing this well. And after all, we understand that China plans to pursue a strategy of what we can best describe as system destruction against us and our allies and our coalition partners. And I'm just thinking about how Mike Dam, who is a noted China expert, characterizes what he calls a cottage industry in China that focuses on how to attack Link 16. And there's thousands and thousands of papers on this. And what we should take away is that as long as we remain predictable, as long as our networks are static, we are enabling China's strategy. So what do you think we should do about this? And how do we get the mission integration tools to the warfighter? And how do we create more adaptive architectures?
Well, you know, so the first part is funny. We've all heard that story, you know, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. Well, yeah, that's it, right? Congress and the Air Force need to resolve the disconnect that not only prevents research agencies like AFRL and DARPA from using, remember that special software money, Budget Area 8, from broad area announcements, but it also needs to figure out how does it create money that allows those research agencies to seamlessly transition these crucial programs to the operational community. And so we allow the operational community to normalize that rapid fielding and adaptation as part of operations. You know, the prohibitions on mutable software, it's going to impact more than just mission integration tools. Any learning algorithm risks the same fate. So bottom line, we can't let the speed of money slow down the speed of software or the color of it prevent mission integration tools or any kind of learning algorithm from reaching the warfighter.
Absolutely. I want to say I can't believe it, but you can't believe that the funding categories are actually what's preventing us from fully developing and fielding these software programs that you're talking about. So what else don't we know?
So these software programs, because they're enterprise-wide, and we talked about that, right? It's not tied to a specific weapon system or a specific platform. We need to treat each one of these software tools like they're their own individual programs of record, consolidated and managed by a dedicated and focused program office. That's another thing that'll be really important, and it'll help us understand and begin to knit together all those different capabilities.
So Lucky, doesn't that already exist? Doesn't the Rapid Capabilities Office own the Advanced Battle Management System?
Yeah, you know, Slick, and that's a really great point. But we have to remember that ABMS, the Advanced Battle Management System, is a little different than these mission integration tools. They definitely overlap, though. You know, the RCO may or it might not be the right home for these mission integration tools. But it is clear that these software shouldn't be subject to the good graces of a sponsor weapon systems modernization dollars. You know, again, to really reap the full potential of the suite of tools, they need to be funded as independent program of records. So having a SPO that's dedicated to this mission integration, you know, even the Lifecycle Management Center's XA, their integration office, might be a high potential solution. That'll be important to enabling a program executive officer to identify the interdependencies, the gaps, and opportunities as they come together as a system. Again, it's that enterprise-wide type of vision.
Okay, so let's say we're able to do these things, get the money right, have a dedicated SPO. How do we operationalize these tools?
Yeah, Slick, so that's really the crux of all this. We have to get the money right, we have to get the management right, but we also have to get the manning right. So the tools need people to employ them. It's not like software just shows up and magically changes stuff. We're going to need specialists who deeply understand operations, networks, and all of those relationships and interdependencies. So these specialists can't just parachute in. They're not like, you know, the IT team that comes in, fixes your computer, and leave. No, they need to be embedded, everyday operator, mission plans side by side with our warfighters. And not just because we need them to have an expertise, but also because adaptations will happen on a daily basis or even mission by mission. So if the Air Force is going to achieve a rapid adaptation of its operational architectures, it must push these tools and these people to the unit level. And guess what? JCOs, who we talked about earlier, are a natural fit to meet this need because of their battle management experience and their knowledge of current network architectures. So with some additional specialized training, these mission integration officers could accelerate those kinds of appropriate changes at forward operational locations. You know, as we alluded to previously, they hold not only established and full-time billets at unit level, their resources from a physical space to commuter terminals or funding, all of this, again, needs to be normalized through O&M dollars to enable them to exist at the operational unit type of level, just like any other mission planner or operator would be.
Well, Lucky, I do want to push back a little bit on this because we talk a lot about adaptation at the unit level, but there's a reason why monetization and mission data file updates and software changes are centrally controlled because it's all about risk and standardization. So do you propose how we could manage this with these mission integration tools?
You know, Slick, that's a really great point, and you're absolutely right about it. I mean, we have to acknowledge that risks exist every time, anytime we're going to change something in a non-centralized kind of way. So risk has to be managed, but the benefits of this kind of edge adaptation are really simply too great to ignore. So to manage that risk, and frankly, also optimize the potential of these tools, the Air Force really should experiment with and begin to develop mission integration tactics, techniques, and procedures for training, employment, and risk management. I mean, it really comes down to developing those kinds of TTPs, just like we do for jets. We can do the same thing for software.
Yeah, no, I really love that. And, you know, we shouldn't think about these mission integration tools as just software, but as a capability that we need to employ just like any other weapon system.
Yes, like exactly. I mean, these really, we need to think about mission integration tools as a capability because they will become more and more important to how we fight. They're going to connect and be the bridge between our legacy force, our current force, and our future force. And really, this kind of software is what's going to enable these kinds of operations. And it's not just the glue, but it's going to be how we employ it. But right now, we risk losing our ability to shape, deter, and win in a peer conflict due to the bureaucracy. You know, we're letting bean counters and administrative processes guide what we can field and how we can fight, not the combat requirements. I mean, I'll tell you, no war was ever won by a spreadsheet.
Well, Lucky, that is a powerful point to end on, and I couldn't agree more. And I really want to say thank you for your time. We here at Mitchell would also love to extend our thanks to Mike Benitez and Dr. Jimmy Rev Jones for their insight. And it's clear for me that to all of this that we need to make bureaucratic changes that will accelerate operational change.
Yes, like, thank you so much.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.